One thing we all learned last year is that the coronavirus pandemic has dramatically shifted the college experience.
Testing, college admission, financial aid, so many of those things are simply changing.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about getting into college during COVID. We'll also hear how the Army is challenging students to find their inner warrior and spend an academic minute exploring the future of cities. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The coronavirus pandemic has inched its way into just about every part of our life. We already know that the college experience over the past 12 months has been completely transformed. But students are now finding out that applying for college, paying for college, the entire admission process that they've been preparing for looks completely different. This is where our friend Rob Franek comes to the rescue. Franek is the editor-in-chief at the Princeton Review and the author of the new book, College Admissions During COVID, How to Navigate the New Challenges in Admissions, Testing, Financial Aid, and More. In the book, he frankly outlines all the changes that students and parents should know about as they begin choosing and applying for a college. I just spoke to Rob Franek about the book, and I asked him how the coronavirus pandemic has affected college admissions.
Oh, Bob, there are so many things. I mean, when I talk to students and their parents and even counselors, you know, I'm saying that many of these issues that are affecting students, you know, who are college-bound, but in every way, testing, college admission, financial aid, so many of those things are simply changing due to the effects of COVID, and those things just need to be addressed. So that's what we tried to work on in the book.
So does this mean if you're applying for college, you should start sooner?
Not start sooner, but I think about the process in a different way. And that's for a couple of reasons. I never want to make students more nervous or their parents worried about the process. But the truth is that the recruitment process from colleges and universities themselves have changed. And just for a couple of quick things, we understand that so many colleges and universities, nearly 3,000 of them in the states alone, missed their class, their incoming class for the fall of 2020. So some schools are reporting, 5% down, those students that decided not to matriculate, not to become students for fall of 2020. Some schools are reporting 35 or 40% misses. So we understand that schools have to recruit differently. Number one, to fill in that gap. And then number two, to build relationships with students. All of those things being done virtually, and likely that wasn't the protocol in the very near past.
We're hearing a lot more schools now because of the COVID pandemic are going test-free. Is that happening?
Yes. And the nomenclature that many schools are using is test optional, which I tell all of my students, and we have a lot of students coming to the Princeton Review queue, test optional does not mean test prohibited. And I'll give you an example. I'm responsible, my team is responsible for data collection at the Princeton Review. We collect from a little over 2,500 four-year undergraduate schools, nearly 900 of which pre-COVID were already test optional. But Bob, do you know what they report, even test optional schools, to me? Their SAT and ACT scores. So when we think about it, I just don't want students and their parents to be hoodwinked in the process. The SAT and ACT, even for test optional schools, is still valuable, sometimes as a gatekeeper for admission, but even more importantly for scholarship dollars tied to performance and GPA. But combine, cross those strings between GPA and SAT and ACT scores, and it still unlocks scholarship dollars outside of family need just based on academic prowess.
Are students now looking for colleges closer to home because of all this?
Many students are, absolutely, as you say, voting with their feet. They are staying closer to home, likely for health and safety reasons. But that said, during the research process, so many students are still thinking broadly about that process. And I think that says, you know, students are being resilient about this process. They understand that as difficult as these times have been, and I find so much solace in this, that students are resilient. Those students who are college bound right now are saying, this is a tough problem. However, it is our problem to deal with. And that, you know, gives me solace, and I suspect colleges and university admission folks as well. So they're still thinking close to home, but also thinking broadly as well. And this is going to shake out certainly for the fall of 2021 entering class, but I think we'll continue to think broadly as the years progress.
Well, that's what I was thinking. This upcoming class going into fall 2021, some schools might not even know if they're going to have in-person classes yet, right?
You're right. And this is where the paint is literally still being applied. And I think hence the value of so many of the issues that we're talking about in the book. You know, colleges and universities want to first and foremost protect their students, their faculty members, their administrators, everybody on campus. And that's where so many schools are saying, you know, just for those reasons, we have to continue being either 100% remote or some hybrid of a remote and in-person class. And hopefully that will crest as the spring semester progresses into a fully in-person fall. But again, it is very difficult to make that judgment en masse right now based on what we know.
Has there been an adjustment in tuitions with the lack of in-person classes, or is that just a wild fantasy?
No, it's a good thing to bring up. And the truth is, the short answer is yes. However, it's not happened in scale. But I'll give you a couple of quick examples. This is even pre-pandemic. You know, a year before the pandemic, 2 years before the pandemic, several schools have embraced this idea of resetting their tuition, the idea of scaling back their tuition. And the reasons that those schools are doing it, I'm a trustee at my old school called Drew University, which is in Madison, New Jersey. They made this decision about 2.5 years ago to do just that. But the truth was that many schools were discounting their sticker cost tuition to make it affordable for students and parents. So it's really a reset of tuition, saying, okay, we were discounting this anyway, giving scholarship dollars to make it affordable for students and parents, but now let us just bring it down to a palatable sticker price and then charging that for students and parents. Factor in a global pandemic, and many schools are doing just that, answering the question, college is still worth it, but so many students and parents are questioning, is it worth the same amount of money if the classes are simply going to be online? But still, we're not seeing that schools are doing that to a significant scale across the country.
Is there still opportunities for students to get scholarships, to get finance? Is it just as open as it was, or is it going to be more of a struggle?
You know, this question around financial aid is, again, the one that all students and parents likely have on their mind, might be a little nervous to ask, so I so appreciate that you bring it up. The truth is that aid from the federal level will likely stay the exact same. And this is a tremendous amount of student aid available, including access to student loans, whether they're Stafford loans or otherwise. So those things will be there. We don't yet know what is going to happen by way of state underwriting for scholarship dollars and so on. The difficulty, and this is the soothsaying here, the difficulty is not knowing what schools can accommodate, right? So what can schools themselves, colleges and universities, sort of pony up as scholarship dollars? And we can call this discounting. We can call that, you know, tuition that a school is likely not going to receive simply because they're giving it over in scholarship dollars. But we know that schools, because of the cratering for so many schools for the fall 2020 freshman class, they will have to be able to make their school's tuition dollars as attractive to students. So I still have faith that we're going to have money on the federal level, likely on the state level, and on the school level. We don't know how much yet, particularly from schools themselves, but again, they understand that they have to recruit students and make them attractive to that school, not only academically, but financially as well.
And speaking of finance, there was one thing in the book that I had never heard before. What is a need-blind school?
A need-blind school is simply a school that doesn't consider a student and family's financial wherewithal at all. So when they're completely need blind, it simply means that that school likely has great financial resources, financial aid and otherwise, already devoted to that student population. So it needn't know if students and parents have the ability to pay. Now that, you know, leads to the question of are schools there, and what happens to students in the process if their school is not need blind? And very simply, a school can consider a student and their family's financial wherewithal in the process of admission. And I recognize, Bob, that doesn't feel so good, but again, I think students, again, barring any bias here or barring any opinion here, students and their parents need to know what those definitions are and how that can affect them through their academic admission, of course, their attractiveness when it comes to financial aid and scholarship dollars and so on.
We have seen some of the smaller colleges, small rural colleges, closing because they just haven't been able to make it during the pandemic. Are we going to see more of that?
The unfortunate answer there is likely yes. And you capture it the right way. So many schools pre-pandemic, small schools largely are dealing with difficult issues, shrinking student populations coming from different recruitment areas and that school traditionally recruited from, right? So we understand that those factors were there pre-pandemic, but again, factor in a global pandemic, and many schools are going to either sadly close, merge with other schools, or, and this is where the silver lining could come in, think very differently about how they're tackling their undergraduate education and their offerings, whether that be continuously a hybrid model as we move forward, which we may well see. Schools like the Southern New Hampshire University has prided itself and really created its structure around online learning and have profited from that and have profited many students because of that for many years. But again, they are one of the leaders in offsetting that tuition. Even now, nearly 100% online, but bringing their tuition down by, I think it's a staggering percentage, between 30 and 35%.
I imagine the large state universities and the gold standard schools are still going to be doing fine, or are they in the background suffering?
I think every school is suffering, and I'll give you some examples. But you're very right. Let's use Stanford as an example. You know, we do this Dream Colleges list at the Princeton Review annually, and now for the last nearly 4 years annually, we ask students and their parents what would be their dream school if cost and academic admission were not issues. And Stanford has been consistently on both the student and parent list as number one the last few years running. But 45,000 students last academic year applied to Stanford, 4.2% of whom were admitted. Stanford is going to be fine. But when we think about other, let's say, state universities are tied to the earnings that state brings in through revenue opportunities that happen for businesses and otherwise for those states. But again, factor in a global pandemic, and we know that so many of those reliable sources of underwriting that ultimately make it onto schools are going to be simply less this year due to the pandemic than years past. So we don't know yet what's going to happen, but it could possibly factor in that so many schools, public schools, city universities, might just have to raise their tuition or think differently about their offerings due to the pandemic.
Still to come, our conversation with Rob Franek continues with a look at the changes to the campus experience, including the campus visit. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. The This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Rob Franek, the editor-in-chief at the Princeton Review and the author of the new book, College Admissions During COVID, How to Navigate the New Challenges in Admissions, Testing, Financial Aid, and More. During our conversation, we spoke about the dramatic change the college experience has undergone for students. That change actually begins before a student even enrolls, with the campus visit or lack thereof.
It is absolutely different. And that is where I think some schools have struggled because they had to make that tectonic shift of recruitment of students coming onto campus for an in-person open house. I mean, those things are truly a thing of the past due to the pandemic. But so many schools, I think gloriously, have shifted very quickly in adapting to a virtual model of recruitment, an open house day. And I'll give you, I think, a good example. And I teach several students myself, and I was giving a lecture last night, and I said to all of these students, I'm like, listen, you are more comfortable, these are high school students, you are more comfortable on any long online platform than I will ever be. Use your prowess. Use your expertise. If you wanted to visit three colleges in person last summer or during the fall or during the springtime, now you can visit 30 of them virtually. And you have an opportunity not just to shake hands with somebody, but to build a relationship with an admission person, with a career service person, with a faculty member, with a student. You can do them virtually, as our new world dictates, but those can be strong or stronger relationships than you had any opportunity to build in the past. And there is glory in that, and there is definitely a value from an admission perspective from that.
I want to talk about student athletes for a second. I mean, the Crimson Tide and the Fighting Irish are going to be doing okay, but smaller schools and their student athletes, how are they going to get through this?
It is so difficult, and I'm glad that you're highlighting, you know, those schools that we all know about that have brand and perception and, you know, glorious athletic programs that everybody knows about. But the truth is that most schools, Division I schools, Division III schools, it matters not. You know, it is difficult for those schools to weather. That said, the recruitment for students, even for Division III schools, that non-scholarship generating schools, are dictating so many of the best policies for traditional admission recruitment, right? So we understand that the relationships that we're talking about through the admission office also happens through the athletics office at any number of schools, Division I through Division III. That does not change. The experience of student and what is good students and what's going to happen on campus, that's the stuff where the paint is being applied. But I still have great faith, and I don't want to be Pollyannish about this, but I do believe that crossing those two streams of recruitment and relationship build, athletics and admission, are the key to success for fall of 2021 entering class and then certainly beyond.
Well, we certainly hope that life is going to return to normal within the next, say, 18 months at the very worst. Which of these changes are going to stick?
That is the million-dollar question, my friend. And the truth is, and I tell this to my own students, I'm like, listen, we're not going to unlearn what we've learned over the last 10, 11 months of time, right? We likely are going to have, continuously moving forward after the pandemic crests, some sort of online learning that is going to be with us for likely moving forward, hybrid learning, right? We're likely not going to go back to the way things were prior to March of 2020. And the truth is that that's probably pretty awesome for so many students, right? In thinking about just factoring that out, you know, student experience online while they're in college and university now due to COVID is likely going to profit them professionally once they enter into the world, right? We understand that our conversations are done either online or on the phone or just away from each other, but students are now going to have that experience as an undergraduate. And that will loft them well, and I think being well-positioned for jobs upon graduation, because they will already have that vernacular that they can expertly communicate using those platforms.
Again, the name of Rob Franek's new book is College Admissions During COVID, How to Navigate the New Challenges in Admissions, Testing, Financial Aid, and More. Rob Franek is the editor-in-chief at the Princeton Review. With the pool of qualified recruits shrinking, the Army is asking 17 to 24-year-olds one question: what's your warrior? This marketing campaign communicates that there are many ways to be a warrior, and through Army service, soldiers can both contribute to something greater than themselves while improving who they may become later in life. Company Sergeant Major Zachary Lee Bowman leads, teaches, and mentors Army Green Berets. Bowman joined the Army when he was 19 and has served 15 deployments across the globe. He's been awarded one Silver Star, one Purple Heart, and three Bronze Star medals. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Elizabeth Hill about why he joined the military and why he feels the What's Your Warrior campaign is so important.
Before the military, I was in construction. And you know, I thought that was the way that I wanted to go. However, I soon found out that it could be a seasonal job essentially. And so I was, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, and I didn't exactly know, you know, where, you know, I would be staying one month to another. So didn't have a whole lot of stability. Joining the military, it gave me stability, it gave me a sense of purpose, and you know, the opportunity to push myself to the limits.
Could you introduce our listeners to the new What's Your Warrior campaign and tell us what your role is?
I am the force multiplier. You know, I've been in Special Forces Regiment, also known as the Green Berets, for over 13 years. Special Forces is an elite unit that has 9 doctrinal mission sets, two of which are the reason force multipliers stuck with us. One is foreign internal defense, and the other, unconventional warfare. Both in and of themselves are different. However, both have a focus in training and equipping foreign forces to defend against a multitude of security threats in today's operating environment.
And you lead, you teach, you mentor. What skills and characteristics do you try and instill in your trainees?
The trainees, we have many schools and that guys could go to, different skill sets that they can learn. Anything that we teach and train, it's all typically something that they can apply to when we go and teach other foreign forces, whether it be on the range and shooting, or again, you know, methods of insertion, either, you know, diving or even military freefall.
Besides combat, there are many careers within the Army that people don't necessarily think of. What other careers can a young person foster within the Army?
They could become a pilot, cyber operations specialist, they could be a culinary specialist. Personally, you know, in my 20 years, I started out in artillery, and from artillery, after 4 years, I decided that I wanted to go to Special Forces.
We're living in a very divisive time here in America, and a lot of young people may be confused or angered or emboldened by what they see on the nightly news. I was curious what it meant to you to be in the U.S. Army, and furthermore, what would you tell a young person considering a career in the Army?
You know, I'm privileged to be in the Army. It's truly an honor to be in the military, and what I would tell a young person, I would say, you know, don't wait. There are a ton of benefits. Again, you know, I grew up and, you know, didn't have a steady paycheck, didn't know where I was going to lay my head, you know, from one night to the next. But, you know, between a steady paycheck, you could get bonuses. There's, you know, 30 days of paid leave, the medical benefits, opportunity to travel the world, and also the Army pays for college. And Special Forces specifically, you get to work with the best the Army has to offer. Top-of-the-line facilities, top-of-the-line personal trainers and coaches and physical therapists. You get extra pay that you won't find in the conventional Army, and you receive, again, more schooling.
Why do you think it's so important to reach the younger generation?
You know, I kind of look at it when I joined the Army and the generation now. And, you know, when I was growing up, you know, we had pagers. I didn't have my first cell phone until yeah. I was 19, you know. And you see, you know, the younger generation with cell phones all over the place. And, you know, I think they are a native to, you know, technology. And the three things that come to mind with Gen Z is that they're tech savvy, they can adapt quickly, and they are innovative, all three of which are essential to moving forward in the future. Today's operating environment is ever-changing, and the military needs to be able to adapt and overcome as the environment evolves around us.
Is there anything I may not have touched on that you'd like to include?
I think one thing that young people may have concerns about, and I think this is, and I just want to kind of debunk this misconception, is that they can't have a family, or it's hard to have a family, and they can't achieve personal goals, both of which are, again, it's false information. You know, I've been married for 16 years. I've got 2 kids right now. I've got 1 on the way. Just found out yesterday that it's a girl.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And so you can absolutely have a family. And I honestly couldn't think of any better place to raise a family. As far as personal goals, absolutely you can achieve personal goals. I'm currently in college right now. my wife and I, we talked about it. You know, after I come out of the Army, we want to begin missionary work. So right now I'm going to college and studying religious studies so that you're kind of setting up what we want to do when I get out. So a few credit hours away from a degree. So for everybody, know, you can have personal goals and you can absolutely raise a family.
Company Sergeant Major Zachary Lee Bowman leads, teaches, and mentors Green Berets in the U.S. Army. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Elizabeth Hill about the Army's new campaign, What's Your Warrior? To learn more about career opportunities within the Army, you can visit GoArmy.com. So how has this little pandemic thing transformed the way we live in and think about cities? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
What will cities look like in the future? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Alexandro Samas, assistant professor of architecture at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, looks at a post-COVID-19 urban environment.
Cities have long been vital to the growth and health of nations. They're economic drivers and cultural centers, creating community, employment, and common bonds. Yet the social distancing and sanitizing necessary for saving lives during this pandemic actually goes against some of the basic principles of sustainability in the shared economy. These pandemic precautions cannot last in the face of a much bigger problem, climate change. However, while cities will eventually return to shared office space and public transportation, there are things that COVID-19 will leave behind as a long-term legacy in the built environment. The most visible will be the significant changes in the way we work. With many companies announcing working from home as a viable scenario for the future, people will choose to live where the weather is good or salaries offer a higher standard of living. Imagine how this will affect real estate as cities transform. We will soon be talking about a large office building stock in metropolitan areas that will need to be reevaluated, rezoned, and restructured. In the long run, this will have a significant impact on the form of the future city. COVID-19 has also revealed a self-preservation mechanism from governments and the public. If there is a threat, an immediate threat, people will act. This shows us that if climate change is equally perceived as an immediate threat, there is a chance that governments and society will address it. But for now, climate change is still too abstract, too big. It remains to be seen exactly how metropolitan areas will evolve, but they will change. Because of COVID-19, we are seeing an evolution in the future of a city in real time.
That was Alexandros Samas of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.